Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
It's President's Day. For some, that means a day off in honor of our democracy. For others, maybe some shopping. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, February the 20th. Good to have you with us. In the retail economy, President's Day is famous for its discounts, and we're coming off a month where consumers bought more of pretty much everything. As we told you last week, in January, retail sales were up 3% from December, an unusual post-holiday bump. Not every category saw big increases, though. Sales of building materials were pretty much flat, and the recent boom we've been seeing in home improvement spending is expected to slow this year amidst a cooler housing market. We'll get more details when a big retailer in that category, Home Depot, reports earnings tomorrow. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on the outlook.
Oscar and Tika Weaver were holding hands as they exited a Home Depot in Baltimore this afternoon. They'd bought a hammer and also spotted a deal on a fridge, so might be back later today. Though they don't really need a fridge right now.
Just want one that dispenses ice and water.
I'd rather have a Gucci bag.
In January, there were more shoppers like Tika than Oscar. Clothing sales were up 2.5% from the month before. Building material sales were up 0.3%. People bought a lot of homes and building supplies early in the pandemic, points out Natalie Cutler with the advisory firm BDO. But now with rising interest rates,
consumers are putting their new home buying plans aside and they're pivoting and they're focusing more on home improvement and redecorating.
And for a retailer like Home Depot, someone who's redecorating won't bring in as much money as a builder doing a gut renovation. The store needs consumers to buy everything from hammers and refrigerators to the proverbial kitchen sink. Sucharita Kadali is a retail analyst with Forrester.
You're going to need them to do like massive home renovations, $10,000, $20,000 transactions across a number of different categories.
Back at the Home Depot in Baltimore, builder Stephen Washington had a shopping cart full of gray tiles.
It wasn't on sale, though.
It's for a backsplash in a kitchen he's renovating.
We always shop here. Sometime while we're here, it might be a sale. So we're here regardless, sale or not.
Washington says business is pretty good. He says that's because people have to live somewhere. And that somewhere might as well have a new backsplash and a nice fridge. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, markets were closed for the holiday. We'll have some other numbers for you when we get there. If the world is going to avoid even more catastrophic effects of climate change, it's going to take more than switching to electric vehicles and investing in renewable energy. Climate experts say we will also have to remove a lot of the carbon dioxide that's already in the air. There are a few ways we do it now. Planting trees is probably the best known method. But there are new types of technology in development aiming to speed up and scale up the carbon capture process. Adele Peters is a senior staff writer at Fast Company, where she wrote about the first ever direct carbon capture facility in the U.S. It's run by a San Francisco startup called Heirloom Carbon. Adele, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, let's start with the science. As simply as you can, tell me how direct air capture works.
The company I was looking at in this story, Heirloom, is basically speeding up a process that happens naturally. So they are using a powder that's made from crushed limestone, which is a rock that forms using CO2. In nature, that takes millions of years, but they're doing essentially the same thing in about 3 days. They mix the powder.
Wow.
I know. Pretty amazing. They're mixing the powder with water and putting it outside on what looks sort of like baking trays that are stacked up in these tall racks. And as it sits there, the powder acts like a sponge for CO2, pulling it really quickly out of the air. And when they've collected the CO2, it can actually be stored permanently somewhere else.
That's just crazy. I mean, first of all, how you figure out how to do something in 3 days that normally takes millions of years just boggles the mind. But at this point, how much carbon dioxide are they able to capture with this method?
This is still happening on a really small scale. So really, to begin to have a meaningful impact on climate change, it's going to have to be happening at a massively larger scale. And that's kind of what they're aiming for. By 2035, they want to be able to pull 1 billion tons of CO2 out of the air every year, which is basically the same as the emissions every year from the airline industry. So it's a huge amount.
So that's a little over a decade from now. How realistic is that?
I mean, it still remains to be seen, but I think the process that they're using actually is fairly straightforward. And one of the big challenges that they have now is just being able to afford to scale up. And how they do that is to sell carbon offsets basically to companies that want to offset their own emissions. And they need enough demand for that for them to really be able to grow to the level that this needs.
And how much does this technology cost? I mean, what kind of price are we talking at to do this at the kind of scale that's needed?
It is fairly expensive now. What they're aiming for by 2035 is to be able to capture CO2 at about $100 a ton. That is much less than what some of these other technologies are doing right now.
It's tempting to get excited about this, especially when you read that global carbon dioxide emissions continue to go up when we should be moving in the exact opposite direction. And I was wondering, do you think there's a risk of betting too much on carbon removal and therefore not doing enough, you know, to reduce emissions in the first place?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a risk that companies say, okay, we don't need to reduce emissions as quickly as we could because we can turn to offsets or carbon removal instead. And this definitely doesn't replace the need to cut emissions, but to meet climate goals, if you look at the models, countries are going to have to make huge emissions cuts and remove carbon from the air. They have to do both things, basically. So one study said by the middle of the century, we might have to remove as much as 10 billion tons of CO2 every year. And that's on top of everything else that needs to change, like moving to electric vehicles and renewable energy and eliminating emissions as well.
You cover climate change, among other topics. You know, how much hope is this technology giving you? Or do you think it's still too far away to really expect this to solve, you know, this massive crisis?
I think it's still early, but I am actually optimistic both about this and our ability to cut emissions. Most of the technology that we need already exists, and it just sort of needs to be implemented. So I think there is a lot of reason for hope.
All right. Adele Peters, senior writer at Fast Company. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
One industry that's grappling with the effects of climate change now is skiing. Here in the U.S., this ski season has been a mixed bag, with many resorts in the West enjoying more snow than usual thanks to winter storms. But here in the East, not so much. In Europe, alpine ski resorts are struggling because of record warm winter temperatures. The BBC's Imogen Folks reports from Bern, Switzerland.
Europe has been experiencing its warmest winter ever recorded. On New Year's Day, it was heading towards 70 degrees Fahrenheit in Switzerland, the highest January temperature ever in the town of Delémont, north of the Alps. It's come as a shock to people living there.
I grew up in a very small village where we had a very small ski lift, and we just went there skiing after school, and I really grew up like that. It's really part of the culture.
Marcus Roller is co-director at the University of Bern's Tourism Research Unit. He says the view of the Alps from his window this winter is worrying.
What we see now is very high temperatures for a very long time. A lot of skiing areas basically do not have snow at all, or just some artificial snow.
Es ist 10 vor 10. Guten Abend.
The warm, wet weather is making headlines. Alpine winter resorts were hoping for a great season after so many closures during the COVID-19 pandemic. But Christoph Marti, a climatologist at Switzerland's Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research, warns this winter is not a one-off.
In the last 10 years, it's pretty striking that it's already now the third winter with such low snow and warm temperatures. It's really obvious that there is really a change going on.
How will alpine resorts cope without snow? In Adelboden, where the recent World Cup ski races took place, head of slope preparation Tony Hari is perched in a cable car. He's looking down on a narrow, slightly muddy ribbon of snow surrounded by green pastures.
We're looking at the steepest part of the run now. We're going to have to push higher altitude snow down to cover it, then pack it all down with the piste bashers.
Adelboden also has an army of snow cannons that make fake snow, using water and pressurized air. This big resort is determined to hang on to its winter sports, but other, smaller resorts still rely only on nature for their snow. One of those is Splügen, which has had to close its slopes. Ski lift director Hache Birne is trudging across a slope covered not in fluffy powder snow, but in slush.
Look at this snow. It's really wet, like in spring. For skiing, the snow needs to hold together. There's just too much water in this. It's impossible.
But alpine resorts must now face this painful reality, says tourism expert Marcus Roller.
I guess at least 50% of them won't be ski resorts anymore. Some will try to survive. We have very short seasons. So we'll start in January and only go to end of February. I think the only solution is that a lot of them have to go out of business.
With more warm, wet winters predicted and thousands of livelihoods dependent on tourism, climate expert Christoph Marti says the impact could be much wider.
Not just skiing will stop there. It may also mean that the school will close. The bakery will close. So there is a whole chain of consequences.
The future of winter sports across Europe seems uncertain. There are already concerns about a lack of snow for the Alpine World Ski Championships due to take place in February in the French Alps. I'm the BBC's Imogen Folkes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Important for us is to attract talent from everywhere in the world.
Remote workers, take note. But first, let's do the numbers. Here in the U.S., markets are closed for the President's Day holiday. As Stephanie Hughes was just telling us, this is a day when people traditionally hit the stores to hunt for bargains and special deals. It's also, according to the Internal Revenue Service, the time of year when people who call the agency's toll-free hotline to try to sort out their tax questions have the longest wait times. Last year, only about 13% of callers got through to an IRS staffer, according to the Washington Post. The agency's acting commissioner told the Post things should be better this year after some 5,000 additional helpers were hired. European markets closed mixed. Britain's FTSE added a 0.1%. Germany's DAX retreated just a tad. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Americans are in a whole lot of debt again. There was a moment there during the height of the pandemic when credit card balances fell sharply, but they're back up again. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York reports that total credit card debt is now at a record high of $986 billion. And delinquencies are up again, too. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
Is this rise in credit card debt just a return to pre-pandemic normal? Or is it a worrying sign about where the economy's headed?
Yes to both.
Aaron Klein at the Brookings Institution says it is a return to normal, and
pre-pandemic normal ought to concern Americans. It is not normal how much credit card debt this country has, how expensive it is for people to continue to carry that debt.
It's gotten more expensive to carry debt in recent months since the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates to try to get inflation under control. David Silberman at the Center for Responsible Lending says that may be contributing to the increase in credit card balances in a couple of ways.
As interest rates go up, the amount of any payment that goes to interest rather than repaying the principal goes up.
And he says since mortgage interest rates and rates on car loans have also gone up, a lot of people are paying more every month now for their homes and cars.
So they may have less money available for their credit card payments.
At the moment, younger people in their 20s and 30s seem to be the ones who are increasingly having trouble paying their bills in full every month. Chi-Chi Wu at the National Consumer Law Center says that makes sense.
For one thing, younger consumers just starting out may not have as much income as older consumers. And then consumers in their 30s, they're having kids. And we know that one of the worst financial strains for a household is children.
And now that the earlier pandemic-era supports, like the expanded child tax credit, have ended, she says many families have less money to work with. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The technology that allowed a lot of people to shift to remote work during the pandemic has given rise to a new class of so-called digital nomads, people who work online, either for one company or for a number of clients, and travel freely. A survey last year estimated that almost 17 million Americans identify as digital nomads, and many countries are trying to attract these workers, especially people with tech skills. Spain recently passed a law that makes it easier to apply for a one-year work and residence permit. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco has more.
The main aim of the legislation, which is known as the Startup Law, is to encourage more entrepreneurs and foreign investors to make Spain their home. Here's a recent government promotional video aimed at attracting more global workers to the country.
Every time I come back to Spain, I feel like I'm coming back home.
Spain is unique. We have a lot of traditions for more than 2,000 years.
The Spanish government is particularly keen to attract digital talent. Carma Artigas is Secretary of State for Digitalization and Artificial Intelligence. She says the new law was needed to cut the huge amount of red tape for startups.
We really have a lack of high-skilled people to cover the demand of our existing industry. Important for us is to attract talent from everywhere in the world. We have launched the Nomad Visa that allows for a one-year work and residence permit.
The low-tax visa is aimed at some of the 35 million digital nomads worldwide, people who have internet-based jobs that allow them to live anywhere. They have an estimated global economic value of $787 billion per year. Around half are in the US, according to research by the independent workforce management company MBO Partners. I met Jen Greaves, a British digital professional who is keen to get one of the visas, at a table outside a cafe in the Spanish capital, Madrid.
As someone who works remotely, Spain, for me, is a really exciting country. I've always loved the culture, the people, the language, and Madrid is a city where there's a lot of energy.
Although the new visa will offer tax advantages, for Jen, the main benefit is to allow her to base herself in Spain.
In a post-Brexit world, I have 3 months in every six that I can be in Europe, and the rest of the time I have to leave. So to establish a life here, to have a lease and build friendships and things like that, that's very stop-start without this visa.
Some businesses now specialise in helping digital nomads with travel arrangements. Lynn Spreadbury, who's based in Madrid, works for such a company called Remote Year. She's seen a huge rise in the number of customers since the COVID-19 pandemic.
People actually want to spend extended periods of time in different destinations instead of just wrapping up after a holiday and going home. So these digital nomad visas are great because they're now allowing people opportunity to stay for a longer period of time in the country.
Other countries are also offering incentives. Portugal has a similar visa scheme, and Argentina is offering $500 in spending money to those who stay for more than 3 weeks. The competition to attract global talent is certainly growing. It just remains to be seen who wins. I'm the BBC's Guy Hedgeco for Marketplace.
While inflation has slowed down, last week's CPI report showed consumer prices were still more than 6% higher in January than a year ago. And this means a lot of people have less money on hand for extras, like, say, photo shoots. So we're checking in with Liz Hansen, owner and photographer at Chicago Boudoir Photography Studio, to see how she's faring.
I always have said that opening a business was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Having a baby is the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, raising a child is the hardest thing I've ever done. Having a business, the second hardest thing I've ever done. The third hardest thing I've ever done is try to grow that business. It's been great. We have lots of women who want to come in and have an empowering experience at the studio. And as we got more and more women who wanted to come into the studio and have their photo taken, more and more clients interested in what we had to offer, it turned out that I could not do all of this on my own. I'm just one person. So we have hired some people. I've hired a woman who does my photo retouching. I've hired a woman who does my album design. So if you come to my studio and you purchase a beautiful album, which a lot of my clients want to do, she helps do the album design and ordering and printing. I noticed that a lot of photographers were super, super talented artistically. They were creating beautiful images for their clients. They were creating a fabulous experience at their studio, but they still weren't making very much money. So about 8 months ago, I decided to launch an educational platform where I help photographers to really reach their business goals, really run their business, you know, focusing on their numbers, focusing on systems that can be repeatable so that they can create beautiful art and sustain themselves as well. Because listen, if you're an artist and you're not making any money, it's very hard to keep creating your art. Trying to understand, to help them understand that, you know, investing in my coaching program would be a great idea and that I can help them get their sales up. That's hard for them to get their mind around during this inflationary period. Before I started my business, like I didn't have a lot of experience in managing other people. I mean, besides managing my toddlers, I wasn't managing a sales team in a corporate job. I had been a stay-at-home mom before I opened my business. What I've learned as a business owner is that a lot of this is like my own personal growth. I feel like I've learned a lot and grown a lot personally, professionally, in all the ways. It has stretched me and changed me in all the good ways and also in all the really hard ways.
Liz Hansen runs a photography business in Evanston, Illinois. This final note on the way out today, would you pay for verified status on Facebook and Instagram? Parent company Meta is hoping lots of people will. The company announced yesterday it's launching a new paid subscription service called Meta Verified, starting in Australia and New Zealand at first. For $12 a month, or $15 on the iPhone, users can submit their government ID to receive a blue verification badge, which was formerly reserved for celebrities and other public figures. The move follows the rocky rollout of a similar pay-for-verification service on Twitter, known as Twitter Blue. Earlier this month, The Information reported that as of mid-January, paid subscribers made up less than 0.2% of active U.S. Twitter users. All right, here's your moment of economic context, or maybe geopolitical context, on this President's Day. Bloomberg ran some numbers on President Biden's surprise trip to Ukraine. The visit, according to officials, involved a 4 a.m. departure from a military airport outside Washington, a 10-hour train ride from Poland into Ukraine, a 5-hour stay in Kyiv, and the announcement of an additional $460 million in military aid. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.